Happy 4th of July to all of our American viewers. Will you get a big, beautiful bill to help celebrate the day, or just a great big pile of debt? Syria is being invited in from the cold, but could rolling out the red carpet for former jihadists backfire? And Germany continues to make some surprising military firsts. We're going to look at all this and more on today's Trumpet World. Well, our main office in the US is closed for July 4th, so we're each recording these segments separately today rather than sitting down for our more regular panel discussion. We're going to hear first from Andrew Miller on the big, beautiful spending bill before crossing over to Mihailo Zekic for an update on the Middle East.
Today marks 249 years of American independence. Yet after nearly a quarter of a millennia in existence, America is suffering severe financial problems. The House of Representatives is rushing today to get Trump's big, beautiful bill passed before the weekend. The Senate had taken the original House bill, added even more tax cuts, and then even less spending cuts to make the deficit even bigger, and put it back to the House for approval. So now there's a lot of drama in American politics over this bill. Elon Musk is one of its leading critics, saying that the Republican Party and the Democratic Party are actually acting as one big spendthrift party called the Porky Pig Party. Whereas Donald Trump has said this bill is absolutely necessary to make America great again. You'll hear a lot of politicians say, like, oh, we need to grow out of the national debt. Growing out of the national debt just means that your income needs to increase faster than your debt payments do. So your debt to income ratio comes down. But the national debt's growing at 5.4% a year. And if we increase our borrowing, it may start growing faster than that. So unless you're actually, your economy is growing more than 5.4% a year, you're not going to grow out of the national debt. And I think only the most delusionally optimistic person is going to say that Trump's tax cuts are going to make America's growth rate go from 2.8%, which it is currently, up above 5%. And so really putting this into a biblical perspective, I only need to quote one verse today in Deuteronomy 28, verse 43. This is the blessings and cursings chapter about, it tells you what God considers a blessing and what God considers a curse. One of the curses for a nation that disobeys God's law is that others shall lend to you and you shall not lend to others. So it means you're basically saying that, like, if you're a net debtor nation, you've turned away from God's law. If you're a net creditor nation, you're following God's economic laws. And so America's definitely the biggest debtor nation in the world. And this big, beautiful bill is going to increase its debt even more than it is already. Really just factoring into this Deuteronomy 28 curse that will destroy America's financial might just by sheerly by being over-leveraged by debt. And in this case, like I said, sticking with our Uncle Sam analogy, you're basically telling someone who's making $52,000 a year and spending $70,000 that they don't need to make any cuts. In fact, they can up their spending to $72,000 or $73,000 and still be all right. And that's just simply not true. The big, beautiful bill isn't the only big news in America this week. There's several what I'd consider smaller but still important stories. One shocking one also has to do with a congressional vote where one congressman basically introduced a resolution just simply to condemn the LA riots. Now, anarchists protesting Donald Trump's efforts to deport illegals have caused about $30 billion worth of damage in Los Angeles. So the House of Representatives introduced a resolution to condemn that behavior, and about 195 Democrats refused to vote for that bill. As a matter of fact, of all the Democrats in Congress, only 7 Democrats were willing to come out and say that burning police cars is bad. The other 195 says that, like, well, if you're protesting Donald Trump's deportation agenda and you burn a police car or cause $30 billion worth of damage, we are not willing to say that's wrong or condemn it in any fashion. Which really just shows how radical the Democratic Party has become, basically becoming like a pro-anarchist party that's stirring up insurrection in American cities. This probably shouldn't come as too surprising, though, as they took another poll here on the 249th anniversary of American independence, and only 36 Democrats said they were proud to be American. That's down from 87% in 2001. So back in about a little over 20 years ago, in the wake of the 9/11 terrorist activity, the vast majority of Democrats, even though they disagreed with Republicans, were still proud to be American. Now the majority of Democrats are not proud to be American, which goes a long way to explain why they're unwilling to condemn anarchists who are burning the American flag and waving the Palestinian flag and waving the Soviet Union flag and waving the Mexican flag, because this party has become a party that's basically willing to support any country on earth except their own. And then one final story, and actually what could end up being a big win for Donald Trump and the nation. The Supreme Court ruled 6-3 that district court judges do not have the constitutional authority to issue nationwide injunctions. For the first several months of the Trump administration, district court judges had issued at least 40 injunctions against the president, saying that certain things he was doing was unconstitutional, really going a long way and just kind of like stopping Trump from enforcing American border laws and doing some minor spending cuts and other things. So the Supreme Court finally came in and said that the district courts were not created by the Constitution. They were created by act of Congress and given jurisdiction only over their district. So a district court judge can't tell the president of the United States what he can do nationally. That's a check and balance reserved for Congress and for the Supreme Court. The district court judges can only rule within their district. So this ruling could go quite a long way at restoring basically the constitutional rule of law in America and fulfilling a prophecy we've been looking for quite a while in Amos 7, where it talks about an end time Jeroboam being supported by the king's chapel and the king's court. And the king's court, that Hebrew word for court is bayit. It means house. And it talks about basically a small household that enforces the law. Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has identified the Supreme Court as the king's court. And so this new ruling is actually giving the Supreme Court much more authority in terms of supporting what is the law of the nation and not just letting any district court judges, there's about 700 of them, have veto power over presidential actions.
United States President Donald Trump announced that he was lifting all U.S. sanctions on Syria as of July 1st with an executive order. So there are still plenty of sanctions in place on Syrians involved in the things that the Assad regime did, but now that there is a new government in Damascus, the United States has determined that the sanctions over Syria as a country, as a whole, can be removed. Per the fact sheet, these sanctions relief includes relaxation on exports controls, waives restrictions on certain foreign assistance, orders Secretary of State Marco Rubio to review the designation of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, the new group in charge of Syria as a terror group, and its leader, President Ahmed al-Sharaa, as a specifically designated global terrorist, plus the Syrian government's designation as a state sponsor of terrorism. This is what the fact sheet said, quote, "President Trump wants Syria to succeed, but not at the expense of U.S. interests. While seeking to re-engage constructively, this administration will continue to guard against all threats and monitor progress on key priorities, taking concrete steps towards normalizing ties with Israel, addressing foreign terrorists, deporting Palestinian terrorists and banning Palestinian terrorist groups, helping the United States prevent a resurgence of ISIS, and assuming responsibility for ISIS detention centers in northeast Syria," end quote. So you could see, just with this blanket waving of sanctions, there's a lot more in here than just America seeing Syria as not a threat anymore. There is a concentrated push to make Syria a new partner with the United States in a variety of areas. The mentioned normalizing ties with Israel, we'll get there in a moment. Taking over ISIS detention centers in northern Syria, that's basically, the U.S. does have a mission in northern Syria helping out with the Kurds, and that's basically the U.S. government saying, okay, we'll step aside, the Syrian government can take over, regardless of whether the Kurdish groups there want that or not. And the fact that, as I was mentioning earlier, this group that's in charge of Syria, the leader of that group right now, is currently listed as being part of a terror organization, that obviously, it's surprising then for these sanctions to be unilaterally lifted out. But it's not just the United States that's looking at the new government in Syria, looking at President Sharaa as somebody they could work with. So is Israel. The U.S. has been prodding Syria and Israel to come to a rapprochement with the new status quo in the region, but the Israelis have been dragging their feet for a while, as you can imagine, with somebody that's belonged to a terrorist organization setting up shop right next to Israel's northern border. But on June 22nd, Israeli National Security Advisor Tzahi Hanegbi had a classified meeting where, according to Israel Hayom, he confirmed the Israeli government, quote, maintains direct ongoing dialogue, end quote, with the new Sharaa government of Damascus. Hanegbi reportedly, again according to Israel Hayom, quote, identified Syria and Lebanon as prime candidates for normalization agreements with Israel, building on the Abraham Accords model, end quote. Report from Lebanese media, meanwhile, suggests that Syria, in these high-level talks, has even produced a list of demands, a draft of conditions for normalization, and these apparently include even the new government in Syria recognizing Israeli control over the Golan Heights. That's a part of that's a patch of territory that was under control of Syria several decades ago, but Israel got control of it in 1967, and years after that, formally annexed it. Syria and Israel have had negotiations for normalization in the past, going all the way back to the 1990s and Benjamin Netanyahu's first term. But the Golan, who controls the Golan, it's a really strategic piece of real estate. That's always been the sticking point, and that looks like it's no longer going to be an issue. So the United States and Israel take this new government in Syria, led by Ahmed al-Sharaa, very seriously, very openly, as a potential partner for peace. Is that smart? Well, for the most part, Syria right now is a much better place to be in than it was under the Assad regime. Freedom House publishes an annual index on the most free countries in the world are, and prior to his ouster, Bashar Assad, Syria was ranked as the worst sovereign state in the world in terms of freedom, worse than North Korea, worse than China, worse than all these other places. Sharaa has done a lot to open up Syria to Western products, for example. Those are no longer banned, to freedom of access to information, to exposing a lot of the Assad regime's crimes, stamping out prisons, exposing mass burial sites. But does that mean that this new Syria is a partner for peace? After all, the Assad regime is a pretty low bar to pass. Well, it's worth remembering that HTS, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, this group that now controls Syria, it's been fighting the Assad regime for years, but it wasn't fighting for freedom and democracy. It was fighting during the Syrian civil war as originally a branch of Al-Qaeda, the same group that attacked the United States on 9/11. They publicly split from Al-Qaeda, and there's been some debate as to how much they have connections with their former patron. But Shirah himself, he was trained as an Al-Qaeda terrorist. He based what he was doing with HTS, what he was fighting for in the Syrian civil war, on establishing an Islamist dictatorship under Sharia law in Syria. And that's what everybody fighting under him signed up for. Speaking of those that signed up, there's also been a big issue of foreign fighters, people coming from places like Xinjiang, the Muslim region in northwestern China, flying over to Syria, joining HTS, again, to fight to establish an Islamist dictatorship. And this, I read it out in the fact sheet there. The White House wants a lot of those people gone. There's been stories from weeks ago of the Syrian government saying, no, we're going to assimilate them into, at least some of them, into the regular army. And the United States has given its green light for that. In March, probably the biggest case against the new government happened, where there was cases of ethnic cleansing against the Alawite minority. It's an offshoot of Shia Islam that lives mostly on Syria's coastline. And Reuters, on June 30th, just before the White House announced this new policy, published an exclusive report exposing the Syrian government's complicity in these acts of ethnic cleansing. It's a small quote. Reuters found nearly 1,500 Syrian Alawites were killed and dozens were missing. The investigation revealed 40 distinct sites of revenge killings, rampages, and looting against the religious minority, end quote. And this report has confirmed that the new government, units of the new government's military of its security services, were responsible for much of the violence and carnage. It wasn't just them, it was also independent groups, but they had a large portion of the blame to share, including the General Security Services, which has now been turned into Syria's new Ministry of Interior. So Shirah has been in power only for a few months, since December, about half a year, a bit over that. He hasn't really had much of a chance to implement his new vision for Syria. Syria, obviously, still, there's plenty of different militias controlling different bits of Syrian territory, so he doesn't even have complete control over the country yet. But in this small window of time, relatively small window of time, we're seeing that, okay, this new government, maybe they're taking some steps that look positive, but they're still doing a lot of the stuff that they've been fighting for years. They still stand behind a lot of those old ideals. And the people, including those foreign fighters that came into Syria for no other reason than to establish a Muslim dictatorship, they still believe in what they signed up for. They still believe in the cause. So Syria maybe might be a slightly better place to live in right now than under Bashar al-Assad, but it's jihadists in suits running the show there right now. They know they don't have much power there. They know they have to bend a little bit to or adjust their ideas to get sanctions relief, to get peace with Israel, to get money flowing in so they could start reconstructing the country after a devastating civil war. But that doesn't mean all of a sudden they're all good liberal Democrats. And Bible prophecy brings us an interesting perspective in light of all these developments. Prophecy that we go to often is in Psalm 83. It describes a coalition of peoples coming together, quote, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. That's in verse 4. Verses 6 and 7 detail the people that make up this alliance, quote, the tabernacles of Edom and the Ishmaelites of Moab and the Hagarenes, Gebal and Ammon and Amalek, the Philistines with the inhabitants of Tyre, end quote. There's no record of this alliance ever forming in biblical or secular history, whether of these particular peoples or for that purpose of blotting out the name of Israel from memory, as it describes in verse 4. That's why Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has pointed to this prophecy, or to this passage being a prophecy, something yet to be fulfilled, a yet future event for now. But it doesn't really make that much sense unless if you know who the peoples in question are. For this program, I just like to focus on one of them, the Hagarenes. And if you can compare it through biblical records, there's plenty of resources on our website, including a trends article we could put into the show notes that mentioned that the Hagarenes, those are the ancient inhabitants of Syria, that it's part of the land it's talking about is part of Syria today. And so the Syrians are going to be involved in this alliance to attack Israel, along with a lot of other groups. The Ishmaelites are mentioned there. That would include the Peninsular Arabs, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, countries like that, Ammon and Moab. That's the land that's in Jordan today. The capital city of Jordan is Amman today. A lot of these so-called moderate Arabs, a lot of these so-called countries that right now, at least on the surface, have pretty friendly relations with the state of Israel. And because of this, the Trump has expected for years that Syria is going to become partners with these moderate Arab countries, that it's going to turn away from its overtly radical image and become almost looking like a partner for peace. Now, this is what Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury wrote in January 2021. It was in response to the development of the original Abraham Accords. That's the peace treaties that Mr. Trump brokered between Israel and the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, two of these Gulf Arab states, two of these Ishmaelite countries that, in their case, they are on the other side of the Middle East from Israel. They don't even have a long history of war with Israel. So you would think that this would be an obvious peace plan that would work, that there's nothing going to hurt it. But this is what he wrote, quote, "We all want peace, but sadly, these recent peace pacts have a deadly flaw. Biblical prophecy gives us deep insight into these agreements. It actually foretells that moderate Arabs will unite, somewhat like we are now seeing, but they are prophesied not to cooperate with the United States or Israel. A prophecy in Psalm 83, we just read that, exposes a hidden reality behind these peace deals. We are already in the beginning stages of its fulfillment," end quote. So Mr. Fleury links the Abraham Accords, these peace deals, with the United States, with Israel, as being a key part in getting the Psalm 83 alliance going. And as I mentioned, the UAE and Bahrain, these are countries that are small, they're not really been historical enemies of Israel. Syria has fought several major wars with Israel for decades. So even though it may look like President Shirah is moderating his image because he has to, again, you just scratch underneath the surface and you see the betrayal of Psalm 83 poised to happen. And the United States and Israel are contributing to Syria getting this veneer of becoming a new peaceful country and even almost walking into a trap of their own making. But it's not the only failing peace program that there's been updates on this week. On July 1st, President Trump announced a ceasefire deal for Gaza that Israel has reportedly accepted. Hamas has still yet to respond. According to President Trump, this is supposed to be putting in a 60-day temporary truce, whereas a handful of hostages will be returned from Gaza, while negotiations during that time will be ongoing to make the ceasefire permanent. Hamas has always said they're not going to accept any deal that isn't permanent from the get-go, so this could very well be a sticking point. President Trump said on social media, quote, "I hope for the good of the Middle East that Hamas takes this deal because it will not get better. It will only get worse," end quote. Now, one anonymous Israeli official commentating this told Axios, quote, "We'll do to Gaza City and the central camps what we did to Rafah. Everything will turn to dust." He continued, "It's not our preferred option, but if there's no movement towards a hostage deal, we won't have any other choice," end quote. So all eyes are on Hamas right now. If they take it, if they don't, this could mean dramatic things going on for Gaza. This is not the first time when President Trump drew a red line and other parties decided to cross that red line and nothing happened. But at the same time, we also saw what happened with Iran's nuclear program. So there'll probably be some developments on that coming up in the days ahead. And then yesterday, Axios reported that U.S. Special Envoy to the Middle East, Steve Witkoff, the president's main man for negotiating a lot of these peace deals, a lot of these accommodating appeasement peace deals with aggressive actors in the world, he's planning on restarting nuclear negotiations with Iran. Iran said that they're not interested in right now with everything the U.S. did. There's no point talking, but it looks like those are going to go ahead next week with Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi in, of all places, Oslo, Norway. I think that's a pretty interesting location because that's where Bill Clinton, former President Bill Clinton, started the Oslo Accords. That's where they're named after, between Israel and Yasser Arafat and the Palestinians, which led to Israel disengaging from much of the Palestinian territory, which was the stepping stone to October 7th and a lot of other problems Israel has been having on that front. But the fact that's happening in that location, I don't think the symbolism was lost with the United States with that. And so that may be a suggestion, a veiled message to Israel to start getting their act together and let the U.S. do whatever peace deals they want. And they're going to have to accept it one way or another. We'll have to wait and see. But either way, big developments in the Middle East this week, and they're certainly bound to have ripple effects going on in the days to come.
Thank you for that, Mihailo. I wanted to cover a series of news articles showing that Germany is becoming a trusted, militarily normal nation. Several of the news events this week revolve around that. Just this week, Rheinmetall finished building the very first facility outside the US to make the central section for the fuselage of the F-35 stealth fighter. So the most advanced plane on the planet, at least I think in terms of what militaries are actively using right now. And America is bringing Germany into the trusted circle of those that not just use it, but help build it. The factory held a completion ceremony on July 1st in Wies in Germany, and the Rheinmetall CEO was there. He announced that production could begin as soon as tomorrow. Now, I haven't heard that production has started, but certainly it seems pretty imminent. The F-35 was called the Joint Strike Fighter for a while, at least while it was in production, as it was a US-UK joint project, with the rear fuselage being built here in the UK, and it was a symbol of the special relationship between these two countries, that they were both working together on this advanced fighter jet. Now, you know, I have to admit, I think America did put up a lot more of the money and do a lot more of the work. But it was a cooperative venture between these two. And now you see Germany, in a way, coming into that relationship. And I think that's pretty symbolic, that it's now the UK, US, and Germany. And I think there might be a few others that are making bids for this as well. But the Rheinmetall CEO, he said that the central fuselage, he called it the most important part of the aircraft because it houses all the essential technology. So look at what America has now trusted Germany with. They've given Germany their tactical nuclear weapons. The F-35 fighter jet is a stealth plane that can deliver these tactical nuclear weapons. So you've got nuclear weapons that can be delivered in a plane that's invisible to radar. And now with production of the most important part of that aircraft and all of the information about the aircraft that goes along with not just operating, but building it, it is a huge level of trust. And there's another story from this week that shows Israel in the Middle East putting this same kind of trust in Germany. So Germany and Israel announced plans to establish a cyber research center, where they aim to deepen cybersecurity and intelligence cooperation. The German Interior Minister Alexander Dobrindt announced that on Sunday. Now, we've seen Israeli cyber units in action, or at least we don't have a lot of the details, but we've seen the effectiveness of what they can do during the conflict with Iran. And they're hoping now that with Germany coming along, both nations can improve their capability here. They talk about how this will give Israel more funding to develop their own cyber capabilities, and that they'll be able to learn from Germany, get some cooperation there, and that Germany can benefit from Israel's very practical experience in this area. But again, you've got Israel and the United States, the Jewish state in the Middle East, the United States, Britain, all looking to and trusting Germany completely. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry wrote about this subject when America first agreed to sell Germany F-35 fighter jets in an article, America Trusts Germany with Stealth Nuclear Fighters. And we could put a link to that in the show notes. And he wrote there, in the Bible, God condemns America and Britain and the other modern descendants of ancient Israel for forsaking him and for doting on their lovers. And today, what do we find ourselves doing? Arming two warlike nations, our historic enemies, with nuclear firepower. This is an appallingly dangerous mistake. And then further down, he said, God has a strong view about cozying up to such lovers. It is a matter of trust. America has no trust in God for protection, so it is trusting another nation, in this case, one with a terrifying history. We have put human beings ahead of God. God condemns modern Israel, especially America, Britain, and the Jews, because they have, quote, forgotten me. This is a serious mistake these nations are going to come to regret. Another story from this week that is, I think, a small but revealing story comes from the fact that Germany has announced plans to send the first warship to Greenland, or Germany's first warship to Greenland since World War II. So the German Defense Minister Boris Pistorius, on June 30th, he got up there and outlined Germany's plans for the Arctic, where he wants to have more patrols in the Arctic, and Germany showing its presence there. He was up there alongside his Danish counterpart, and the two of them were talking about working together, and he announced that they would be sending the warship Berlin from Iceland to Greenland and then Canada. What's interesting is all the rhetoric around this was we need to defend the Arctic from Russia. But where have you seen Greenland in the news over the last few months? It's not been Russia talking about Greenland. It's been the United States. It's been President Trump talking about wanting to buy Greenland or otherwise get control of Greenland. And it's no coincidence that Donald Trump has been talking about getting Greenland. And for the first time in, what, 80 years or more, Germany sends a warship to Greenland. This isn't just about defending European waters or what Europe sees as their waters from Russia. It's also about staking a claim on Greenland, trying to make sure America doesn't get Greenland. And this is not the first time that Europe has talked this way. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, she said on May 29th that she dreamed of a united Europe from the Western Balkans to Ukraine and Moldova, from Greenland to the United Kingdom and beyond. I mean, Greenland was actually left the EU before the UK did. They remained part of Denmark, but they quit the EU. But the EU still sees Greenland as their territory. So it's a smallish story. It's one warship. But I think it's revealing in that you've had a lot of very credible people, both within Germany and within the United States, warn that as Germany becomes a militarily powerful nation, as they spend a lot of money on their military, they are going to go in a different direction from the United States. And you're not going to see them just content to kind of play second fiddle to America. They're going to want to assert themselves, and they will have interests and goals that are at odds with America at times. And this is a very tangible example of that. They want to make sure that Greenland remains European, and so they're sending a warship there. Now, you have to understand all of this in the context of the master key to Bible prophecy, as Herbert W. Armstrong called it, knowing the identity of Britain, America, and other nations in Bible prophecy. And Mr. Armstrong proved in his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that these nations were descended from the biblical nations of Israel. And we'd be very happy to send you that book for free. It really is foundational to be able to understand what your Bible says about modern world events. And Jesus Christ had conversations with his disciples about what would happen at the time of the end and Bible prophecy. You know, he told his disciples, you need to be watching Bible prophecy. You need to be understanding these things. He didn't tell them, well, don't talk about that. That's a bit fringe. He really embraced that. And, well, how can we understand what the Bible says about world events without understanding what nations it talks about? You know, you can search from cover to cover. You're not going to find the United States of America mentioned in the Bible, or the Federal Republic of Germany, or the Russian Federation, or anything like that. It uses biblical language. We need to understand that language. We need to understand how to understand, in a sense, its prophecies about the end time. And it is a coded book. But understanding the modern identity of the nations of Israel unlocks that code. And so Mr. Armstrong proved that in the United States and Britain in Prophecy. And then when you understand that, well, that shows Britain and America, they've both been wealthy and powerful, not because of anything our people have done to deserve that, not because our people are more righteous than any other, but because of promises God made to Abraham, where he said, I'm going to give you this blessing and this blessing, and I'm going to give all of these gifts to your descendants. And those weren't fulfilled in just the Jews, because the Jews aren't the only descendants of Abraham and aren't the only descendants of Jacob and of Israel out there. And God intended us to use these blessings to be an example to the world, to point the world to God, show them that his way of life leads to blessings, just like Abraham demonstrated, that living God's way of life and faith in God leads to wonderful blessings. And instead, we've used all of those blessings for evil. And so now God is behind and God is raising up nations to punish us. And Britain, America, Israel, and the Middle East, we're trusting foreign nations. We're trusting Germany. We're not looking to God. And you look at, say, Israel's surprise attack against Iran, there's huge scope for surprise attacks to do a lot of damage in this age of drones and cyber warfare. Mr. Flurry's drawn particular attention to the role that cyber warfare could have in fulfilling many of these prophecies. And now you see Israel inviting Germany into the inner sanctum of Israel's cyber warfare and working together with them, trusting them completely. There's huge scope for a trusted ally to turn and do a lot of damage. And we can kind of think, oh, but that's a bit outlandish. That's, you know, that's 19th century behavior. We're too sophisticated in this modern world for a modern country to turn around and launch some kind of surprise attack. Well, the Bible says human nature hasn't changed, that we're not getting better and better, that we're not more moral, more morally sophisticated, geopolitically sophisticated than we were 100 years ago. Okay, we have better technology and a better understanding of science, but we're not fundamentally any better people or really any different people. And actually, the Bible talks about human nature waxing worse and worse in 2 Timothy 3. We are capable of surprise attacks and stabbing each other in the back. And so the Bible warns that if we don't repent and turn from our sins and turn from these things that we're doing that are causing evil, that are causing suffering all around the world, well, God is going to use other powers to correct us. And ultimately, this is about bringing the whole world back to God and back to living a way of life that leads to joy and peace and happiness. And Mr. Armstrong talks about all of that and lays that all out so clearly and in a way that you can prove from your Bible in our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. It's, again, such a fundamental book to understanding world events. I'd really encourage you to read that. You can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. You can order your own free print copy and go over it alongside your Bible. And we'll put a link to that in the show notes. Well, that's it for Europe. For a final section, we'll hear more from Jeremiah Jacques and about what's been going on this week in Asia.
The big story for Asia is that Xi Jinping, the paramount leader of China, may soon see his power reduced. So there have been signs for months now of pressure just really beginning to build on Xi Jinping. We've seen some military chiefs who were extremely loyal to him removed from leadership. These men were loyalists. And so their ouster was not part of the usual purges that are designed to really increase Xi Jinping's power. Quite the opposite in these situations. These guys were part of Xi Jinping's inner circle. So their ouster was actually a big surprise to China watchers because they showed that some of the other factions within the Chinese Communist Party were exercising greater power and even alienating Xi Jinping from some of his most important allies within the party. There have also been some strange things like Xi Jinping's personal bodyguard detachment has been cut in half in recent weeks. So his entourage is much smaller now, and that has raised some eyebrows. And then the Chinese Communist Party also failed to release a statement during the month of June about their monthly Politburo meeting. That was highly unusual. So all of these have been just some strange signs from out of Beijing, but all of that would not really have been enough to be a story. But what does make this a real story is the Politburo report for June. This report was late, and news hawks for a little while had been wondering if maybe there would be no Politburo report for June, just as there hadn't been one for May. But on the last day of June, the Politburo did report on its meeting, and it announced that it had passed a new document. This document is very brief. It's just about 300 characters. It's called the Work Regulation for the Central Decision-Making and Coordination Body. And when you first look at this, it looks like just another dull government memo. But this report has actually been sending shockwaves throughout the China-watching community. And that's because it restructures how the central leadership in Beijing makes decisions. And it places some notable new checks and balances on certain leadership groups that Xi Jinping himself established. He set those up to really consolidate and centralize his power, and they let him bypass some of the traditional structures, such as the State Council and the Politburo Standing Committee. But now, with this new policy in place, these once untouchable groups will be overseen by men outside of Xi Jinping's inner circle, and they'll be regulated and possibly even dismantled. So this probably doesn't mean that Xi Jinping is going to be kicked out of office tomorrow or anything as drastic as that, but it does show that some significant checks are being placed on his power. And who knows, maybe this could lead to something more dramatic for him in the months ahead. But this is a very interesting development from the perspective of the trumpet, because we've long been expecting China to form a close bond with Europe. And that's because of prophecies in the book of Isaiah that we've been expecting that. This chapter is all about an alliance of nations that will soon come together, and China and Europe are two of the main players in the alliance. But Xi Jinping, though, he has been quite antagonistic toward Europe, just as he's been antagonistic towards the nations of Southeast Asia and toward the United States and towards Japan and many others. Xi Jinping has really steered China onto a confrontational path. And this is one reason why China is currently suffering very serious economic downturn. You know, there's very little transparency from China, especially in recent years, but what data we do see paints a grim picture of the economic situation there, and that's largely because of Xi Jinping's antagonistic and confrontational approach. And that's almost certainly why other leaders within the Chinese Communist Party are now working to reduce his power. So what this means is that we could be soon seeing the return of a much more technocratic kind of leadership in China, kind of a leadership style that scales back all of that direct confrontation with other nations, particularly in Europe. And that could give the China-Europe partnership a major boost, just like the boost that we've been expecting at the trumpet because of biblical prophecy. So it's still early days on this, and there's still a lot that we don't know. But this new Politburo document is significant. It doesn't mean that Xi Jinping will be kicked out, as I said, but his wings are clipped. And in the short term, I wonder if this could even prompt him to wage some kind of a Hail Mary out of desperation just to try to save his position. Maybe that could take the shape of an invasion of Taiwan. We don't know for sure, but in the longer term, this does open the way for China and Europe to forge a deeper relationship, just as biblical prophecy has said that they soon will be. And we have a free booklet all about those prophecies. It's called Isaiah's End Time Vision by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury. And it shows us what we should expect in the months and years ahead with the China-Europe relationship. So if you'd like to understand that in the biblical context, I hope you'll order your free copy of Isaiah's End Time Vision. And then there are just a couple of other smaller stories here that I wanted to mention. First up, Japan and the United States have failed to reach any sort of trade deal President Trump said Monday that it looks like there might just be a permanent 25% tariff on goods that Japan wants to sell in the United States. And that is a serious tariff. That's the sort of thing that really deteriorates the power of a national relationship. And Japan, for decades, has been a very close partner to the United States economically and politically and even militarily. Japan has been a staunch ally to the United States. But President Trump is angry that Japan doesn't buy more American rice and more American cars. He's also unhappy that the Japanese don't finance more of the U.S. military bases that are located in Japan. So there are some deep fissures emerging now in the U.S.-Japan alliance, and we expect this to lead to an eventual rupture, a full rupture in the relationship. And then I wanted to end with a pretty ridiculous story about the next Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama is the title given to the head of Tibetan Buddhism, at least to one of the main schools. And the current Dalai Lama has been recognized as that leader since 1937, when he was just 2 years old. But he's just about to turn 90 now in a couple of days, so his days in this world are numbered. And Buddhists, of course, believe in reincarnation. They think that after the current Dalai Lama dies, that his consciousness will be reborn inside of a new human body, in the body of a baby boy, and that that boy will then become the next Dalai Lama, the new head of Tibetan Buddhism. So that's their belief, but the problem is Tibet has been colonized by China. The Chinese most recently conquered Tibet back in 1950, and the Chinese Communist Party are atheists. There's no God in communism. Chinese Communist Party leaders believe that they themselves are the highest beings in the universe, and they hate all religion. They actually fight actively against religion in China because they view it as a threat to their own power. That's the main reason why the current Dalai Lama fled Tibet a number of years ago, and he lives in exile outside of China, where it's harder for the Chinese Communist Party to control him or kill him. So the Chinese do see religion as a serious threat, but they do take a bit of a measured approach in their control of some religions. Like with Catholicism, for example, they do allow it to be practiced inside of China as long as the Chinese Communist Party gets to appoint the bishops and other Catholic Church leaders. That way they can make sure that there's no leaders who are preaching a message that goes against them and their power. So that's how it is with Catholics. And the situation is somewhat similar with Tibetan Buddhists. The Chinese allow Buddhists to practice within China, but only under strict state control. So now that the Dalai Lama is not long for this world, everyone is speculating about who his successor, the 15th Dalai Lama, will be. And there was a hilarious statement from the Chinese Communist Party on Wednesday. This was an official statement from a spokesman, Mao Ning, and it said, "The reincarnation of the 15th Dalai Lama must be approved by the Chinese Communist Party's central government," end quote. And actually, I'll just read another short part of this statement. It says, "The Chinese government upholds a policy of religious freedom, but there are regulations governing religious affairs, including a management system for the reincarnation of Tibetan living Buddhas," end quote. So this is very silly. The communists are basically saying, okay, Dalai Lama, your consciousness can be reborn inside the body of a baby boy after you die, but only a baby boy that we approve of. So, you know, most governments stop having power over their people after those people die, but not the Chinese Communist Party. They think that their jurisdiction extends all the way into the afterlife and all the way into this indefinable metaphysical realm of samsara, where, you know, where the Buddhists believe their consciousness continues as this karmic stream and is transferred into the next body. And it is amazing because we've heard of the Chinese Communist Party making its ridiculous claims that it controls Taiwan and that it controls the entire South China Sea. There's even been some statements saying after China builds a lunar base that it should assert control over the moon. But here we see the Chinese Communist Party going beyond all of that and into the afterlife and asserting control over that too. So it's really par for the course for the Chinese Communist Party, but it does underscore just how they see themselves as the highest beings in the universe. And it shows how dead set these people are on controlling China and Asia and eventually all that is.
Thank you so much for joining us on today's Trumpet World. Thank you to George Haddad and Victor Granados for piecing these segments together and giving them some polish. You can get in touch with us at trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com or leave us a comment below wherever you're watching this, and we'd be very happy to hear from you. You can read the articles, the books, the booklets that we've discussed on this show on our website, thetrumpet.com, or look below for show notes. We will be back on Wednesday with our regular show, and until then, keep watching your world.